managed a knot on the fourth attempt. Mr. Motivator next to me grunted and groaned, but was sounding a bit happier.
"It's working, Nick. I'm getting warmer, mate."
He beamed, blowing out the snot from his nose. I muttered encouragement through gritted teeth as I held the thread and wire, shaking the snow off my gloves and quickly putting them back on. My hands were now so wet they stuck to the innards. After trying to get some blood circulating by clapping them together for a while, it was gloves-off time yet again. As I bit on the free end of silk thread with my teeth, it seemed to take forever to grasp the dangling wire in one hand and the square of silk in the other. At last, I began stroking the wire along the silk, repeating the motion over and over, always in the same direction. After about 20 strokes, I stopped, making sure there were no kinks in the thread that would affect the balance of the metal once I let go. I fished in my pocket for the torch, switched it on, and put it in my mouth. Still crouching over it to make sure the wind wouldn't affect the thread and needle, I let go and watched it spin. The short length of wire eventually steadied, just moving slightly from side to side. I knew the direction of the North Star from my snow marker, which was now quickly disappearing in the storm, so all I had to do was identify which end of the wire magnetized by the silk was pointing north. I could tell the difference between the ends from the way the Leatherman had cut them. The huffing and puffing went on behind me as I shivered and worked out what I was going to do next. Getting through this weather tonight was going to be a nightmare, but we absolutely had to be at that rail track by morning. In theory, moving cross-country in these conditions was a huge no-no, but fuck the rules. It was too cold for them now. I didn't care about leaving sign. I needed roads to make distance, and, besides, if Tom or I, for that matter, started going down with hypothermia, we were more likely to find some form of shelter near a road. My new thought was to go west until we hit one, then hang a right and head north for the rail track. One of the few things I knew about this country was that its main highway and the one and only rail track ran east to west between Tallinn and St. Petersburg. The roads on either side were bound to make their way to it eventually, like streams towards a river. Nobody was going to see the torchlight in this weather, so I turned it on again and looked down as I let the metal drop and had another check to make sure it still worked. As the compass needle oriented itself, I realized that the wind was doing its bit to help. It seemed to be prevailing from the west, so as long as I kept it in my face, I would be heading the way I wanted. I was ready to go. Gloves back on, the silk in my pocket, the compass thread and needle wrapped round my finger. I turned to Tom, who was squatting up and down with a vengeance, his arms swinging wildly. "Okay, mate, we're off."
"Not long now, Nick, eh?"
"No, not long. A couple of hours, tops." Chapter 44. The gale had become a blizzard, bringing close to whiteout conditions. I was having to stop every 10 or so paces, rubbing the needle again with the silk to reactivate the magnetic effect before getting another navigation fix. In this visibility, there was no way I could keep us moving in a straight line. We were vaguely zigzagging west, still hoping to hit a road. We'd been going for about 40 minutes. The wind was still head-on, and its stinging cold made my eyes stream with tears. I had nothing to protect my face with. All I could do was bury my head into my coat for a few moments' respite. Freezing flakes blasted their way into every gap in my clothes. I still led the way, breaking the trail, then stopping, though no longer turning to allow Tom to catch up. When I heard him move up behind me, I'd go on a few more steps. This time I did stop, turning my back to the wind, and I could just make him out coming towards me in the storm. I'd been so concerned about navigating that I hadn't noticed how much he was slowing down. I crouched over on my knees to protect the silk and magnetized the wire while I waited. He finally got level with me as I was trying to stop the wind affecting the compass, which was dangling from my mouth. His hands were buried into his pockets, and his head was down. I grabbed hold of his parka and pulled him down next to me, positioning him so he could give the compass some shelter too. I wrapped up the compass, but this time didn't get to my feet. Instead, I just stayed where I was and shivered with Tom. Both of us bent over in the snow. The snow that had built up on the outside of his hood had frozen, and my hat probably looked the same, matching the front of our coats. "You okay, mate?" It was a bone question, but I couldn't think of anything else to say. He coughed and shivered.
"Yeah, but my legs are really cold, Nick. I can't feel my feet. We're going to be okay, aren't we? I mean, you know all about this outdoor stuff, don't you?"
I nodded. "It's a fucker, Tom, but just dig deep, mate. It's not going to kill us." I was lying. "Remember what I said? Dream, that's all you have to do. Dream, and this time tomorrow, you know the rest, don't you?" His iced-up fur moved in what I took to be agreement as I added, "We'll be on the road soon, and the going will get much easier."
"Will we get a car when we get to the road?"
I didn't answer. A nice, warm vehicle would be heaven. But who would be mad enough to be out here on a night like this? I struck out into the snow and he reluctantly followed. We had a result about 20 minutes later. I couldn't see any tarmac, but I could make out the shape of tire ruts under the newly fallen snow, and the fact that the snow suddenly wasn't as deep as it had been everywhere else. It was only a single-track road, but that didn't matter. It could be enough to save our lives. I started to jump up and down on the spot to make sure I was right. Tom took a long time to catch up, and when he arrived I could see his condition had worsened. "Time to sort yourself out, Tom. New phase. Just jump up and down and get the body going." I tried to turn it into a bit of a game, and he half-heartedly joined in. It wasn't that long ago that he'd been crying. Now it was sarcasm.
"Not long to go now, I suppose."
"No, not long at all." We started to make distance, huddling together at junctions to protect the compass. Whether a road ran northeast, northwest, or even due west, we took it. Anything to get us in the general direction of Tallinn and the rail track. After about 3 hours, Tom had slowed down dramatically. I was having to stop more and more and wait for him to close up on me. The fight through the snow and the extreme cold had definitely got to him, and he couldn't stop shivering. He pleaded with me.
"I've had it, Nick. Everything's spinning around me, mate. Please, we have to stop."
The wind whipped the snow against our faces.
"Tom, we must keep going. You understand that, don't you? We're fucked if we don't."
The only reaction from him was a moan. I pulled his hood apart so he could see me.
"Tom, look at me."
I pulled his chin up.
"We must go on. You must help me by keeping going, okay?"
I moved his chin again, trying to get eye to eye. But it was too dark, and every time the wind got into my eyes, they started to water. It was pointless trying to get any sense out of him. We were wasting time and losing what little heat we had by just standing still. There was nothing I could do to help him here and now. Our best bet was to get to the railway track and make the final push to a station. I wasn't too sure how many k's we still had to cover, but the most important thing was to get there. I'd know when he'd finally had enough, and that would be the time to stop and take some action. I grasped his arm and pulled him along.
"You've got to dig deep, Tom."
We moved on, me with my head down and Tom past caring. It wasn't a good sign. When the body starts to go into hypothermia, the central thermostat responds by ordering heat to be drawn from the extremities into the core. This is when your hands and feet start to stiffen. As the core temperature drops, the body also draws heat from the head. Circulation slows down, and you don't get the oxygen or sugar your brain needs. The real danger comes from the fact that you don't realize it's happening. One of the first things hypothermia does is take away your will to help yourself. You stop shivering, and you stop worrying. In fact, You are dying, and you couldn't care less. Your pulse will get irregular. Drowsiness will give way to semi-consciousness, which will eventually become unconsciousness. Your only hope is to add heat from an external source. A fire, a hot drink, or another body. Another hour passed. Soon I had to push Tom from behind. He took a few steps forward, stopped, and complained bitterly. I grabbed his arm and dragged him. At least the extra effort warmed me up a bit. The cold was taking its toll on me, too. We moved on, painfully slowly. When I stopped to check direction, Tom couldn't help me any more. He just stood on the spot, swaying, as I turned my back to the wind, trying to create shelter for the compass. "You okay, mate?" I shouted behind me. "Not far now." There was no reply, and when I'd finished and turned for him, he'd collapsed in the snow. I got him to his feet and dragged him on. He had almost no strength left now, but we had to crack on. Surely they couldn't be that far to go. He mumbled to himself as I pulled him along. Suddenly he stopped resisting and ran forward with a burst of manic energy. "Tom, slow down!" He did, but only to stagger a few meters off to the side of the road and lie down. I couldn't run to him, my legs couldn't carry me that fast anymore. When I got to him, I saw that the trainer on his right foot was missing. His feet were so numb that he hadn't noticed. Shit. It had been there minutes ago. As I'd dragged him along and protected my face from the wind, his trainers had been the only things I'd seen. I turned back down the road and retraced his quickly disappearing sign. I found the shoe and trudged back to him, but getting it back onto his foot was not far short of impossible, my numb fingers trying to tie the laces which were frozen with ice. I touched my little finger to my thumb to make the old Indian sign that means, "I'm all right." If you can't do that, you're in trouble. "You've got to get up, Tom. Come on, it's not that far." He didn't have a clue what I was saying. I helped him to his feet and dragged him on. Now and again he would shout out and summon up another burst of energy. Fuck knows from where. It didn't last for long before he slowed down or fell back into the snow with exhaustion and despair. His voice had become a whine as he begged to be left where he was, pleading with me to let him sleep. He was in the latter stages of hypothermia, and I should be doing something about it. But what? And where? I pushed him on. "Tom, remember, mate, dream!" I doubted he understood a word I was saying. I felt sorry for him, but we couldn't rest now. If we stopped for even a few minutes, we might not restart. It was about 15 minutes later that we stumbled onto the railway line, and only by chance did I notice it. We'd reached a level crossing, and I had tripped over one of the tracks. Tom wasn't the only one losing his core heat and spiraling down through the spectrum of hypothermia. I tried to summon some enthusiasm to celebrate, but I couldn't manage any. Instead, I shook him. "We're here, Tom. We're here." No reaction whatsoever. It was obvious that what I said would make little difference to him now anyway. Even if he showed any awareness, what was there to get excited about? We were still in the shit, wet, freezing cold, with no shelter. And I didn't know how or where we were going to get on the train, even if it turned up. He collapsed on the crossing next to me. I bent down and got my hands under his armpits, heaving him up again and nearly collapsing myself in the process. He couldn't control his mouth or teeth and began to make strange snorting noises. "We have to keep going just a bit further," I shouted into his ear. "We have to find a station." I didn't know any more whether it was him or myself I was talking to. I turned left towards Tallinn. We staggered west over the snow-covered hardcore at the side of the track. At least the trees on either side gave us some protection from the howling wind. It was 30 minutes, an hour, since we'd got onto the track. I didn't know. I'd given up clock-watching long ago. Tom started to go crazy, screaming at the trees, crying, apologizing to them, only to fall down again and try to cuddle up in the snow. Each time I had to pick him up and push on, and each time it got a little bit harder. We came across a row of small sheds, visible only because of the flatness of the snow on top of their angled roofs. We still couldn't see further than about 5 meters, and I didn't notice them until we were right on top of them. I fumbled excitedly for the torch, leaving Tom on his knees, shouting at the trees that were coming to get him. It seemed to take forever to press the switch. Soon my fingers wouldn't be able to perform even a simple task like that. I shone the light around and saw that the sheds were made of wood and built in the form of a terrace, the door of each facing onto the track. Most were clamped shut with old, rusty padlocks, but one was unlocked. After kicking the snow away, I pulled it open and turned round for Tom. He was curled up in the snow on the track and pleading to be allowed to sleep. If he did, there would be no waking up. As I gathered him in my arms, he lashed out with his final reserves of strength. He was having a fit. It was pointless struggling with him. I simply didn't have the energy. I let him drop to the ground and, gripping his hood with both hands, pulled him along like a sledge, stumbling backwards and falling over with the effort. I didn't talk to him anymore. I didn't have the strength. The door was so low that I had to bend down to get in, and the roof wasn't much higher. By the instant I was out of the wind, I began to feel warmer. The shed was about 8 feet square, and the floor was cluttered with bits of wood and brick, old tools, and a rusted shovel with a half-broken shaft. Crap from over the years lying on a frozen mud floor. Tom just lay where I dropped him. As I put the torch down to give me some light, I could see him curled up in a ball. His hands exposed, wrists bent, as if he had suddenly developed severe arthritis. His short, sharp breaths mixed with mine, and looked like steam in the torchlight. Not long now, and he would be history unless I got a grip on myself and sorted him out. If only this was a hunter's cabin, not a rail worker's shed. It's the custom in extremely cold climates to leave kindling in huts so that someone in trouble can rewarm themselves quickly. It's also the custom to leave a box of matches with the ends sticking out so that frozen, numb fingers can grasp them. I got my gloves off and started to fantasize about warm train carriages and hot mugs of coffee. I dragged over a lump of wood that looked as if it used to be part of the paneling. I then played about with my Leatherman with shaking hands, trying to pull out the blade. Once my soaking gloves were back on, I started to scrape at the edge of the wood. I wanted to get to the dry stuff underneath. Tom filled the room with his screams and cries. It was as if he was speaking in tongues. I yelled just as loudly, "Shut the fuck up!" But wherever he was, it was a place where he couldn't hear me. Once I'd cut away the damp stuff and exposed the dry wood, I started to scrape thin shavings onto the shovel face. This was the tinder. My hands hurt as I tried to keep a firm grip. Tom's body had started jerking around in the corner of the hut. We both needed to get this fire burning soon. But I couldn't rush what I was doing, or I'd fuck up completely. Next task was to cut kindling, a stage up from tinder, so that larger bits of wood could then be placed in the fire and stand a chance of catching. I picked up any sticks of wood I could find, and also pulled off some of the roof lining and tore it into strips. It would burn well because it was partly coated with tar. Then, with the rest of the small bits of wood, I started to make fire sticks, cutting very thinly into the side of the wood, and pushing out the shavings until each piece looked as if it had grown feathers. Tom was no longer thrashing around on the floor. Mumbling incoherently to himself, he was kicking out, as if fending off an imaginary attacker. It was pointless talking to him. I needed to concentrate on building the fire. Survival training might not be my strong suit, but I knew about fire. It had been my job to make up the one in the front room every morning before my stepdad got out of bed. Otherwise, it was slapping time. Usually it was slapping time anyway. Once I'd prepared about 5 fire sticks, I stacked them around the tinder like teepee poles. Then I got out my pistol, taking off the magazine and pulling the top slide to eject the round in the chamber. Using the pliers of the Leatherman, I eventually pulled the heads off the 3 rounds and poured the dark grain propellant onto the tinder. My hands were shaking as I poured, trying my best to get it over the wood and not the mud. I left the 3rd round half full of propellant. Tom's frenzied movements had dislodged his hood. Placing the round carefully on the ground so I wouldn't lose its contents, I got up and crawled over to him, my muscles protesting now that they'd had a rest. My cold, wet clothes clung miserably to me as I moved. I got hold of his hood and tried to pull it back on. He lashed out with his arms, shrieking stuff I couldn't understand, his hands flailing around and knocking my hat off. I collapsed on top of him, trying to control him as I got his hood back up and my iced hat back on. "It's all right, mate," I soothed. "Not long now. Remember to dream, just dream." But I was wasting time here. It was heat he needed, not bullshit. Crawling back to the shovel, I dug inside my glove for the compass silk, held it in my teeth, and cut some off with my Leatherman scissors. Then, using the screwdriver, I rammed the cut silk into the half-empty case as wadding on top of the propellant. I loaded the round into the weapon, pointed it at the ground, and fired. The signature was a dull oomph. There was no reaction from Tom as I knelt on the ground to pick up a glowing, smouldering bit of silk. Once it was in my fingers, I waved it about gently to fan the glow, then put it into the tinder. The propellant flared, lighting up the whole hut. I must have looked like a witch making spells. Once the tinder had caught, I started inserting more little bits through the fire sticks into the flame. It wasn't yet giving out much heat. That wouldn't happen until the tinder was hot enough to ignite the fire sticks. I got in close and blew gently. The fire sticks started to crackle and hiss as they released their moisture and smoke. I could smell burning wood. I fussed around the flames on my hands and knees, carefully placing wood for the best effect as the hut filled with smoke and my eyes started to water. The flames were now higher, and threw dancing shadows on the walls of the hut. I could feel the heat on my face. I had to get more wood before all my good work was undone. I looked around and gathered up as much as possible from what was to hand. Once I'd established a fire, I'd be able to venture outside into the howling wind for more. I kicked the door open slightly to get rid of the smoke. It let some of the wind and snow whistle in, but it had to be done. I'd block up most of the gap as soon as I could. Tom was much quieter. I crawled over to him, coughing smoke from my lungs. I wanted to see if there was any wood under him or in the corner. There was, only a few bits and pieces, but it all helped. I couldn't make a big fire as the hut was too small, and besides, we wouldn't need it. The walls were so close that the heat would bounce straight back on us anyway. I checked the flames and started to feed on some more wood. "Not long now, mate. We'll be getting our kit off in a minute because we're so hot." The next priority would be a hot drink, to get some heat directly to Tom's core. Placing the rest of the wood near the fire to dry it out, I turned and looked at his face. "Tom, I'm just going to see if I can find something to heat snow in for a..." He was lying too still. There was something very odd about the way his legs had now curled up to his chest. "Tom?" I crawled back to him, pulling him over and getting the hood off his face. Illuminated by the flames, it told me all I needed to know. Tilting his head towards the fire, I pulled open his eyelids. There was no reaction to the light. Both pupils stayed as fully dilated as a dead fish's. It wouldn't be long now before they clouded up. I could hear the fire sticks now collapsing on each other, with glowing embers as well as flame. It was a wonderful sight, but it was too fucking late. I tried his carotid pulse. Nothing. But that could be just my numb fingers. I listened for breathing and even tried his heart. Nothing. His mouth was still open from when he had taken or fought for his last breath. I gently closed his jaw. It was time to think about me. Pulling off my wet clothes, I wrung them out one by one before putting them back on. I sat and fed the flame some more, knowing there were still things that I should do to him. I should try to resuscitate and reheat him until I was so exhausted I couldn't carry on. In the million to one chance he could be revived. But for what? I knew he was dead. Maybe if we dug in for the night, once the weather had closed in, he would still be alive. We would have been in a desperate state in the morning, but maybe he would have survived. Maybe if I hadn't pushed him so hard to get here, or had realized what condition he was in and had stopped earlier. All these questions, and the only thing I was certain of was that I had killed him. I had fucked up. I looked at his limp body, its mouth reopened, his long hair wet against his cheeks, the ice crystals on his bum fluff now melting down his face. I'd try and remember a gobby but happy Tom. But I knew this image was the one that would stay with me. It was going straight to the top of the list of my sweaty, guilty, wake-up-in-the-early-hours nightmares. When I was put into the counselling program the firm sets up for operators now and again, I'd told the shrinks I didn't have them. I was talking bollocks, of course. Maybe it was a good thing I was going to be part of Kelly's treatment now. I started to realize I might need it just as much as her. Dragging him to the doorway, I sat him up against the gap, leaving a space of a foot or so above him for the smoke to escape. I covered his face with his parka. Feeling was already starting to come back to my extremities, and I knew I was going to be okay. All I had to do was find a station. I turned back to the flames, and watched the steam rise from my drying clothes. There would be no sleep for me tonight. I had to keep the fire going. Chapter 45. London, England. Wednesday, 5th of January, 2000. I was nursing a hot, frothy Starbucks in the church doorway opposite the Langham Hilton, the only place I could keep a trigger on the hotel and also keep out of the drizzle. It was breakfast time, and the pavements were packed with overcoated wage slaves throwing Danish pastries and coffee down their necks, and shoppers out early for the sales. Judging by the frenzy, it was clear the Y2K bug hadn't brought the world to its knees after all. It had been the last thing on my mind, as I'd seen in the new century aboard an Estonian fishing boat, along with 26 cold and seasick illegals from Somalia. Slipping away from a seaside village under cover of darkness, we'd battled across the Baltic in huge seas, heading for a peninsula east of Helsinki. Lion King told me it was midnight as we approached the Finnish coastline, where we were suddenly treated to one of the finest fireworks displays I'd ever seen. The whole place seemed to light up as towns all along the shore celebrated the new millennium. I wondered if it held in store any new beginnings for me. Christ, I hope so. It was 18 days since I'd left the hut and set off again into the blizzard. Tom had stayed behind, parka draped over his face, his body sterile of any item that could ID him. They probably wouldn't find him before the spring. I only hoped they'd give him a decent burial. If things worked out well here in London, maybe I'd go back and see to it all myself. Man down and all that. At first light and without Tom, I was able to make distance at my own pace, even in the driving snow, and it was only a couple of hours before I hit a station about 6 or 7 k's away. A train arrived heading west, towards Tallinn, but I let it go without me. The one after that was heading east, towards Russia, and I climbed aboard. Without a passport, it could take weeks to get out of Estonia on my own. But with Eights helping me, maybe it would be a different story. That was why I jumped off at Narva, and that was how I'd ended up on the fishing boats with my new Somalian friends. It had cost me all the dollars in my boot, and it meant spending several uncomfortable days and nights hiding in the apartment with the landmines while Eight got things arranged. But it had been worth it. Eight wasn't too happy about his car becoming history, but he still seemed thrilled to help me, even though he must have been aware of what had happened to Carpenter and the old guy in Vodka, and put two and two together. I wondered if he gave a shit. Eight didn't ask me again about helping him to escape to England. But as I stood on the jetty, waiting to board the fishing boat, I turned to him and handed over Tom's passport. From the expression on his face and the tears in his eyes, you'd have thought I'd given him the 3 million. I knew I was taking a big risk, but I felt I owed him that much. I just hoped he did a good job of doctoring Tom's picture, or that the day he tried to use it, immigration weren't checking their computer screens too closely. Otherwise, poor Eight would find himself being lifted by a team of heavies and whisked off to a 3x9 sooner than he could say, "Crazy boy." I'd told myself then that the passport was part of what I owed him for his help, along with a new car. But now, standing in London with a hot coffee in my hands and time to think, I knew it was more to do with trying to get over my guilt about Tom. I had pushed him beyond his limits in outrageous conditions, and I'd killed him. Giving Eight the possibility of a new life was an attempt to square my conscience and make things right. The job was done. Now cut away. At first I thought it had worked and that things were all right. But I knew they weren't. Not with Tom, not with Kelly. She was much the same. The new year had passed her by too. I'd phoned the clinic twice in the 2 days since I'd got back. I'd lied both times, telling them I was overseas but would be back soon. I was desperate to see her, but I just couldn't face it yet. I knew I wasn't going to be able to look her in the eye. Hughes picked up the phone the second time and told me that her plans for Kelly's therapy sessions, which included me, would have to stay on hold until I got back. I still felt confused about it. I knew it had to be done, and I wanted to do it, but... To add to the confusion, I'd also had a call from Lynn. He wanted to see me this afternoon. There seemed to have been a change of heart since our last meeting. He said he had a month's work for me. I'd been tempted to tell him where he could shove his £290 a day, because if all went well with Liv this morning, I'd never have to depend on the firm again. But there was no guarantee that she was going to appear. And though a month's pay wasn't much, at least I would be working instead of thinking. The exchange was going to be simple. I'd opened a bank account in Luxembourg by telephone as soon as I returned to the UK. The message I'd left Liv in a Helsinki DLB was that she'd be required to move the money electronically using a Fed wire reference, which would guarantee the transfer within hours. When we met in the hotel in a few minutes' time, she would call her bank with the transfer instructions I would give her, and then we'd both just sit and wait until it happened. I would call Luxembourg each hour giving my password and would be told when the money had been deposited. In my own mind, I'd set a cut-off time of 4 p.m. If she hadn't turned up by then, I had to assume she never would. Then it would be decision time about her, and how to go about contacting Belle to explain what Mr. and Mrs. Liv's little girl had been getting up to. As my parting shot, when I was sure the money had gone through, I toyed with the idea of a feeling that I'd saved Tom's life, and that he'd told me the whole story, just for the satisfaction of letting her know she hadn't outsmarted me. After all, I intended having nothing further to do with ROC. All I wanted was the money, and then they could carry on blowing up buildings and ripping people's guts out for all I cared. Deep down, however, I knew that telling her would achieve nothing except to put me in the shit. She hadn't got as far as she had without damaging a few bodies, and I didn't want to be the next one on the list. 20 minutes before the RV time, a taxi pulled up at the hotel's main entrance. As I watched, Gunga Din stepped forward and opened the cab door, and I saw the back of Liv's head as she got out and went inside. We had the taxi between us, but I could see she had decided on the jeans today, together with her long leather coat, collar up against the cold. I let her go in and watched for any surveillance or another vehicle pulling up shortly afterwards. Neither happened. I waited, elated. She was here. She wouldn't have come all the way to London just to announce that she was stitching me up. The 3 million was now so close I could almost smell it. I had earned this money. No, after a lifetime of shoveling shit for peanuts, I deserved it. I'd been working hard to control my excitement as I stood in the doorway, but now I reckoned it wouldn't hurt to let myself enjoy the moment. I ran through my game plan one more time. As soon as the transfer was confirmed and Liv and I had said our goodbyes, I'd call the clinic and tell them that Kelly's new treatment could start straight away. It still worried me a bit, but I just have to get on with it. Who knows, I might even sort myself out. Hughes had said there was no telling how long the therapy would go on for, so I'd been thinking it might be a good investment to buy a little flat nearby and sell it afterwards. I could also start throwing a few builders at my house in Norfolk and get it sorted for when Kelly was ready to come home. Less than 10 minutes to go now. She still had to unload the DLB under the telephone, which held the key card for the suite I'd booked. I'd also left instructions to place the Do Not Disturb sign on the door handle once she entered. I waited and watched. There was nothing to see, apart from a woman getting splashed by a passing bus. I could almost feel the 3 million between my fingers as I counted it in my mind. For about a millisecond, I thought about giving Tom's share to some kind of charity. For a millisecond. Because then I saw Kelly again, sitting like a frozen statue in the clinic and staring into space. Fuck it. She needed all the charity she could get. With just 2 minutes to go, I dodged the traffic and approached the hotel. Gunga Din wasn't there to help me as I pushed past the revolving doors and into the warmth of the foyer. The marble reception area was teeming with businessmen and tourists. I walked around them, past the chukka bar and the reception desk, then took the stairs. I climbed to the third floor, opening my leather jacket and checking the position of the USP, tucked center front of my jeans. I'd gone back to Norfolk last night specifically to pick up a weapon and had found myself mopping up the worst of the flooding that had come through the hole in the roof. Still, it wouldn't be long now before that useless tarpaulin was replaced by solid Welsh slate. Outside the door of room 316, I stopped and listened. Nothing. I pushed my own keycard into the lock and opened the door. She was at the far end of the living room, her back to me, looking out of the windows that overlooked the main entrance. The door closed behind me with a gentle click. "Hello, Liv. It's really good to—" I went to open my coat to draw down, but knew it was useless. The overcoated body that had moved out from behind the cabinet housing the TV and minibar already had his pistol on me. The other body that sprang from the toilet to my left was no more than 4 feet away, his weapon at my head. I released my grip on the leather and let my arms drop to my sides instead of raising them. There could still be a chance to draw. Liv turned towards me, only it wasn't her. She spoke in a soft accent which I couldn't identify. "Step forward, and keep your hands high in the air, please." I did as I was told. The toilet man moved behind me and started to run his hands over my back and legs. It was pointless trying to bullshit them. As he removed my USP, I couldn't exactly claim I was just delivering room service. She said nothing as I was pushed from behind towards the settee. Cabinet man stayed where he was, to my right. The other one was somewhere behind me. The woman pushed past and headed for the door to the corridor. Her blonde hair was dyed. I could see her brown eyebrows. As she opened it, I could see another overcoated man outside. She left, and he came in. He'd been there to block the exit if anything went wrong during the lift. It wouldn't have been hard for him to stop me. He more or less matched the dimensions of the door. Nothing was said as I sat and waited. But for what? I remembered Sergei's face in the 4x4 as he told me about the Viking's revenge. My heart was starting to pound big time. Where the fuck was Liv? Had she been lifted too? Were these guys the Malaskaya? The three square heads didn't speak or move. A feeling of dread came over me. Were they NSA? Was I really in big boy shit? The pulses in my neck kicked up a gear and, not for the first time on this job, I could feel them pumping against my collar. The human door, who was still standing by the real one, must have seen it and recognized the feeling, because he gave me a knowing smile. I did my best to return it. Fuck 'em. I wasn't going to let them see how much I was flapping inside. Long minutes that felt like eternity passed. Then there was a knock. The human door looked through the peephole, immediately reached for the handle, then stepped reverentially aside. "Hello, Nick," Val said as he entered. With him was Liv's train station contact. They both wore dark grey suits. "May I introduce Ignati?" Ignati smiled and bowed his head slightly towards me. "Hello, Nick. I never managed to meet you personally at the station. But knowing so much about you, I feel as if we are old friends." I nodded back, not wanting to say a word yet, as my mind was too busy working out what the fuck was going on. I was scared, confused, and beginning to realize that I was in serious trouble. My best bet was to shut up and play stupid. That wouldn't be hard. Val sat on the settee opposite, while Ignati stayed on his feet and fell in behind. The Chechen looked into my eyes for just a bit too long for my liking, and then he placed a large white envelope on the coffee table that lay between us. "That," he pointed, "is for you." I reached for it, more confused than ever, and pulled open the flap. He settled himself into the settee and adjusted his suit trousers before crossing his legs. Inside was a sheaf of documents in Cyrillic. I stared at them for a long time, not knowing what the fuck they were. "They are deeds for two apartment blocks in St. Petersburg," he said. "Their combined worth exceeds 3 million sterling. I thought you'd prefer an appreciating asset to cash." My mental calculator was working overtime. I was a few weeks in credits with the clinic, but the bills would soon be racking up again. The 3 weeks that I'd been away would already have cost me £12,000, and I'd soon be running on empty. 1 month with the firm at £290 a day would earn me precisely £8,700. I might as well chance my luck. I'd rather have the cash. That was the arrangement. He shook his head, slowly, as if he was about to tell a child the trip to Disneyland was cancelled. "But, Nick, there was no arrangement. Liv has been deceiving us both in pursuit of her own greed." His eyes suddenly went 20 degrees colder, demonstrating with a single glance why he was the top man to be afraid of in his line of work. "Thankfully, some are not as disloyal." He waved his hand behind him. Ignati looked smug. I stared at them as if I didn't have a clue what he meant. "It is quite complicated, Nick, and you really don't need to know the details. Suffice to say, not only did she betray the trust that I had placed in her, she has now made it virtually impossible for me to access the Echelon dictionaries for a very long time. The only reason you are still alive is that you thought you were acting on my instructions. The smile returned. Come, work for me in Russia, and you can then take advantage of your new property portfolio. The rents are extremely high in that part of the city. This is a fantastic opportunity for you, Nick. There might even be time for us to get together so that I can explain this whole sorry affair. I shook my head. I have things that keep me here. I hesitated. I really could do with the money instead. He pointed to the envelope still in my hand as if I hadn't even spoken. In there are the details of a contact here in the United Kingdom, when you wish to come to Russia. He stood up, and everyone moved with him. I had to ask, how did you know I was here? Val stopped just as the human door was about to open the real one. Liv told me, of course. She told me everything. He paused. Before Ignati... He shrugged. His smile hadn't disappeared. He waited to see my reaction. I bluffed it and looked even more confused, but in my mind's eye I saw her belly slit open and the eels writhing all around her. It shocks you. I shook my head. I didn't think so. You see, I cannot be seen to exhibit such a lack of judgment about the people close to me. I must show strength. You could help me do that when you come to Russia, Nick. Think about it, won't you? I nodded, just wanting him to leave. She did mention your apology for the deaths of my nephews. I nodded. Yes, I'm sorry. Don't be. I never really cared for my sister's family. I hope to see you in St. Petersburg soon, Nick. As he turned to leave, I said, Can I ask one more thing? He stopped. There's a body. My friend. It's still in Estonia and... Of course. Of course. We are not barbarians. Val waved a hand at the envelope. The contact. Give him the details. I lay on the settee for the next 15 minutes, trying hard not to think about how long it must have taken Liv to die. It certainly took the edge off my enthusiasm for the St. Petersburg property market. I needed the money, but I wasn't too sure about anything now. Apart from the fact that the meeting with Lynn wouldn't be the best moment to fuck the firm off. I gave Val and his boys another 5 before walking downstairs and out of the hotel. Then I went into one of the phone boxes under the scaffolding and fed in a fistful of coins as I picked up the receiver. Hello, East Anglian Properties, how may I help you?
James Main.
Speaking.
Nick Stone here. Slight change of plan, James. I want you to sell the house as soon as you can, but anything you can get.
But all the offers so far have been well below your purchase price. You'd do much better if you got the roof finished and the interior work done, then put it on the market in the spring. It would be a...
Straight away, James.
But I was driving past the place only a couple of days ago, and there's still a tarpaulin over the roof. Really, nobody's going to offer anything like...
James?
Yes?
Which bit of straight away don't you understand, for fuck's sake?
I only had to put a 20p piece in for the second call. It was to a London number.
Still abroad, I'm afraid, I said, when I was finally put through to Hughes. Looks like I'm going to have to stay here for another month. What effect would that have on Kelly?
Well, she won't get any worse. Let's put it that way. She'll stay more or less exactly as she is until you can start the sessions with her.
Exactly as she is. I closed my eyes and tried so hard to see her looking at me and smiling. But the only image that came to me was of her on that chair. Her head strangely tilted, and sitting so still it was as if she'd stopped breathing, or had been frozen to death in an invisible blizzard.
I had hours to kill before seeing Lynn, and so I ended up walking all the way to Vauxhall Cross. As I walked, I thought about the two other phone calls I might have to make very soon. One was to her grandparents, to break the news that they might have to sell their house as well, though there was more chance of being struck by lightning. They'd nodded and agreed so far that Chelsea was the best place for Kelly, but I bet they'd suddenly discover how wonderful the NHS was when I told them they'd have to start shouldering some of the cost. The other would be to the friend who'd put me onto the freelance job against Val. I'd ask him if he had more work going, and this time somewhere warm, like the Bahamas. The same Asian guy ushered me into Lynn's office. Nothing had changed apart from the fact that Lynn had a different shirt on and wasn't writing this time. I stood in front of his desk. Once again, there was no coffee on offer, so I knew I was in for another short meeting. It's my last few weeks in post, and, quite frankly, the last person I wanted to see was you. He sat and stared at me, with an expression that said I was 100% responsible for his early retirement. I felt sorry for the mushrooms. I knew to just keep my mouth shut and listen. "Moonlight Maze," he said. "Do you know anything about it?" "No." I felt the sharp pain in my chest once again. He knew what I had been doing. He knew and was letting me drop myself in the shit. I had to play along. "Well, not really. Only what I read in the papers a couple of weeks ago." "That's about to change. Your job is to assist an NSA officer and his team while in the UK. They will be here for about a month, trying to stop this damned ROC infiltration into Menwith." I nodded, as if I assumed it would be a boring BG-come-escort-come-tour-guide job, which these things normally are. But I still had the feeling he was playing games with me. "Why me, Mr. Lynn? You said before Christmas that... It has been deemed that the cost of your training and retainer is not being effectively utilized. Now get out!" I didn't know how he did it, but the door behind me was opened by the Asian guy right on cue. "Please, sir, follow me." I did, and we went up two flights in the lift to the briefing area and into a sparsely furnished, unoccupied office. There were no windows, and all I could hear was the noise of the forced air ducts. "If you wait here, sir, the officer will be with you shortly." The door was closed behind me. I sat against the desk and flapped. I was being set up. As it opened again, I stood up and turned to face the person walking in. My chest pain returned with a vengeance. I had fucked up big time. "Nick Stone, right?" The Democrat was smiling at me as he held out his hand. His face looked like I'd gone at him with a pastry cutter. The bright red, scabby scars around his face were held together with black sutures, along with patches of his scalp, where his hair had been shaved before the wounds were treated. His hands were in shit state too, but they were all healing nicely. "There isn't much time, Nick. Me and the team are going to need a lot of help here." He saw me looking at his scars and dropped the smile. "Hey, I know. Not good. If I ever find the son of a bitch that did this, I'm going to be pulling the ring back on one big can of kick-ass." Firewall is published by Random House Audiobooks, a division of the Random House Group. Copyright Andy McNab, 2000. Copyright in recording, Random House Audiobooks. Andy McNab has asserted his right under the Copyright Designs and Patents Act, 1988, to be identified as the author of this work.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.